This Focus with Paul W. Smith podcast is sponsored by Victor's Home Solutions. Visit victors.com, experts in home solutions.
Well, all right. Chris Alberta sitting in for Paul, a little bit redundant perhaps after the technical difficulties. The guys bailed me out there, and the crew is happy to actually have me talking to a microphone where I can hear. So welcome back in. Listen, I heard my good buddy Jason Rowe this morning on Guy Gordon's show, and part of the reason I wanted to get him on was because I have become, as I said earlier, a little bit enamored with the RFK Jr. campaign, in large part because there's a libertarian streak in me that is just dying for someone who is reasonable, a bit anti-government in some aspects. And I love the fact, I just adore the fact that he is legitimately taking votes away from both parties almost in a relatively equal sense. And there's issues that I think all of us agree with him on. Why is he not getting more press? And I don't want to talk about Haley, and I don't want to talk about Trump and Sleepy Joe and everybody else. I want to talk about Bobby Jr. Is there really a chance there? Jason Rowe, the principal at Rowe Strategic, former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party, and purveyor of dive bars everywhere. Jason Rowe, welcome to the program.
Wish I was in a dive bar now. I have to get ready for St. Patrick's Day.
Is this world not just turning into one giant dive bar anyway, Jay?
Touche.
Listen, humor me. I know this is a touch out of your wheelhouse in terms of what's really going on, but tangentially, I look at this RFK Jr. campaign, and having done a pretty deep dive the last couple weeks on all of his videos, a lot of his speeches, a lot of what he's put in print, I find myself increasingly admiring the man for being not only intellectually gifted, but just deeply genuine and patriotic. And I'm wondering, if more people saw this stuff, would he be garnering a bigger share of the electorate right now?
I do think he would gain from that, and I think he will gain from that, particularly as he continues to make an impact. At some point, as this race settles down, assuming that it is Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, you know, he's going to be a factor. You know, whether he is drawing 10% or 20%, who does he take from? Who does he help? What states does he change the trajectory? So I don't know he's in a position to win, but I think he's in a position to have an impact. And that's what will be interesting, is when the deep dives start, do they continue to marginalize him as some type of fringe candidate, which is what I'd say the mainstream media has been doing as of, you know, now? Or do they start to treat him as the legitimate heir of the Kennedy legacy and somebody who has spent most of his life on the liberal left, who's finding some common cause with people on the right now?
Yeah, quite a bit, from vaccines to protecting middle class America and small business, and on and on. And much of what he spends time on outside of the environmental and health-based stuff, in terms of really rallying against private equity taking over some of these small business chains that so many people depend on as a lifeline, he is enormously attractive to very reasonable, even somewhat centrist thinkers who are just so tired of the divisiveness of this environment. But is his only chance to really get on all 50 ballots the Libertarian Party just taking him on? Because I don't really have anybody else. Or am I wrong on that?
No, I mean, ballot access is the number one challenge to non-traditional candidates, because only the established political parties have a process by which they can put a candidate on the ballot. There's, I don't know the number, but a good number of states that, as an independent candidate, the threshold for getting ballot access makes it impossible. So you can't even compete in all 50 states as a truly independent candidate, particularly given, you know, where he's starting in this process. So getting on the Libertarian line would give him the ballot access that he needs. There's a bit of infrastructure within the Libertarian organization nationally, but, you know, some of his views might run contrary to Libertarian doctrine. I do think, though, when you talk about the issues that he's speaking to, the Kennedy family, for what, you know, people think of them as kind of political royalty, and obviously they come from great wealth and kind of the, you know, the one percenters of the Boston Brahmin types. But they've always been avatars for the working class. They've always, you know, whether it was John F. Kennedy or Teddy Kennedy, always represented themselves as people fighting for the working class. And as the two political parties have changed, and the Republican Party is more about the working class today than it used to be, and the Democrats are all about the elites, but, you know, the Kennedys fit more in line with today's Republican Party than they do today's Democratic Party.
Yeah, and we see a bit of that. You know, he's what, just almost 70 years old, and he's in phenomenal shape. Obviously, the voice thing, if you're not familiar with him, he's got a specific disorder where the nervous system is attacking his voice. It makes him sound a touch feeble, but clearly he is as healthy as an ox, doing, you know, push-ups and things and pull-ups. And I mean, he's a pretty virile kind of guy. At this point, between the Democrats and the Republicans, which party is a further departure for him from their tried and true recipe?
Oh, I think the Democratic Party has strayed away from where RFK and the Kennedy, family has been throughout the decades. They've been relatively pro-business, pro-growth. They've been more about a social safety net. They certainly, I don't think as a family had ever practiced the kind of balkanization in which we pit American against American based on, you know, their ethnic or religious identities. So I think there's a lot in the Democratic Party's, current composition that would, I think, repel traditional Kennedy family politicians.
Yeah, it is a hard thing to, it's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of the old school liberals. I mean, even what you watch, you know, the Bill Maher's that 10 years ago were considered extremely left, and that they've come so, you know, center that they're bordering on right in a relative sense. And that's oftentimes what I hear when I hear him talk. I say, geez, I don't know any conservative person in my circle of friends who would listen to this and disagree with the vast amount of what he's saying. In fact, I think they would be hard pressed to find a couple things that they would vehemently disagree with. And I think it's a shame that he's not getting more press. Do we see debates at this stage, when you look at the grand stage with Trump and Biden, will we see a debate, if you had to be a better on this, between at least the two of them, if not potentially the three of them?
Oh, I think we'll certainly see Biden-Trump debates. My guess is that Trump will insist upon Kennedy's participation if he sees it advantageous. And, you know, there's some speculation that he helps Trump right now more than Biden. So, you know, I could see him demanding it. I do want to go back to, though, as you were talking about, you know, RFK and where he is vis-a-vis today's Democratic Party. I think in other places, you know, the Democratic Party is far more aligned with corporate America and big business than they ever have been. And historically, that's been where the Republicans, you know, were, you know, carrying water for big business in America. That's changed. And I think that's another place. And, you know, you look at RFK's, you know, long held views on the pharmaceutical industry, with, COVID up being the most obvious and the one most impactful on everyone. The idea that, Democrats are now carrying the water for big pharma is a departure from who the Democratic Party was just 10 years ago.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And when I hear him talk, I don't remember who said it. Maybe you would remember, because you're an encyclopedia for these things. The goal of our election should be the scenario where both candidates are so appealing and so reasonable that we lay in bed the night before the election still somewhat on the fence, because we're just not sure who to vote for, because they're both choices are so good. And many, he's been a bastion now for people, especially the younger people, 50 and under, who are saying, I can't stand either of these guys. And will Joe Biden really be the candidate after June 4? I mean, is there with a minute to go, is there a trick left in the DNC sleeve where he actually is not the candidate, if you were to bet on it at this point?
Yeah, I'm not convinced that Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee in 2024. There's just too much at risk. His poll numbers are awful everywhere. He never trailed Donald Trump in national polls in the 2020 election. He trails Donald Trump by 2 to 4 points in four polls that came out just in the last week. So I'm not convinced he remains. And, I think a change for the Democrats might also impact how people that don't like either choice, you know, behave, either coming back to the Democratic Party, or sticking with, you know, a Cornel West and RFK. I wouldn't rule out Nikki Haley running as No Labels. You know, that would explain why she's stayed in as long as she has. So I think there's a lot more molecule bouncing to be seen in the next few weeks and months before we have a real sense of what the field looks like.
There will be molecules bouncing everywhere. Should be fun to watch. Thanks for giving us some perspective on that. I know it's not the mainstream thought process right now, but I find it disappointing that more people aren't at least looking into this and saying, boy, what a stark contrast between the left, the right, and a guy that is firmly planted in the middle. Let's just hope and pray that we see some candidacy that reflects more of that in the future. Thanks, pal.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Rieger, after the break, we're lucky enough, I suppose, despite the unfortunate circumstances, to have Mitch Albom join us. He is stuck in Haiti. Are you aware of this?
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on in Haiti where he has the orphanage that he runs. So a lot of stuff going on at the airport, and he'll be able to tell us what's going on.
Yeah, I don't even know what to make of this story other than what I'm reading. Part of the lowering Chris Alberta's blood pressure process has been to consume less news. You know, I've tapered it down from a couple hours every single morning to about 45 minutes to an hour. I didn't even really know that the story was a story until we had to look into it for coverage purposes. It's pretty outrageous what is happening in Haiti.
Oh, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to hear from his perspective. I would bet that he's pretty upset about the lack of help. So we'll get to that in just 100%. A few minutes. Everybody hang tight. You're going to want to hear this one. It is really, really fascinating stuff. Welcome back in. We've been watching this Haiti crisis going on now for a bit, and it is a sad, scary, really tumultuous thing that's happening in a very, very poor country with people who are darn near helpless, if not entirely helpless, against it. And as you know, one of the WJR faithful, Mitch Albom, is deeply involved in Haiti. Have Faith Haiti is the orphanage that he helped support. And Mitch is joining us now, stuck in Haiti as that country's under lockdown. Thanks for coming on, Mitch. I know you're kind of under the gun there with all these circumstances.
That's okay, Chris. I'm happy to be with you.
I appreciate it. Look, everyone I think has heard the gist of this. You were on a little bit earlier. How upset are you, if I can jump right to it, at the absolute way that the international community, especially the United States of America, and we are a hop, skip, and a jump from the shores of Haiti, are ignoring this crisis while we spend billions elsewhere in meaningless conflicts?
Well, it's very frustrating for the people here. I mean, I'm sure it's easy for America to say, well, we don't need to get involved in any other country. And I get that. When you're in America, that's how you feel. But when you look at the people here who are starving, who are poor, living in the second poorest country in the world, who don't have food, who don't have water, and you recognize that America has a history here. We occupied this country for 15 years in the early 20th century. We wrote their constitution. Their money was in our banks. We have a history here. We have an obligation. This is right off of our shores. It's an hour and a half from Florida. And, you know, to for that to be the situation and to not care about it or not get involved when literally people are being murdered in the streets, is to me just shows a lack of leadership. And now all of a sudden the United States is calling upon the Prime Minister Ariel Henry to step down when for the last 2 years they've been supporting him and resisting calls for him to step down. So they don't seem to have a policy at all. But right now I don't want to seem that I'm complaining about politics. We're worried about the safety of our children and the safety of innocent people here, which, you know, who have been dying in the streets left and right. There are bodies, you know, literally left in the street. Nobody picks them up because there are no services here. You know, the police are totally overwhelmed. Police stations are being burned by gangs. They are controlling the airport so that we can't get in or out or fly in or out because they don't want the prime minister to be able to land here in Haiti because he went to Africa to try to get help from Kenya because our neighbors like America won't help. So he gets help from Kenya, and then when he tries to get back in, the gangs are trying to control the airports and so that he can't land. Because if he can't land, then he's not running the country. And they've threatened that if he actually gets in here somehow, there's going to be a civil war. So it's a very, very precarious situation.
Mitch Albom joining us again. Mitch, for those who don't know, if they're not just tuning into this now, this is a series of different gangs who somehow coordinated essentially a takeover while the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, was essentially out of the country flying back from America somewhere. And they have now taken over, released a lot of inmates. Was there a connection to the inmates? Does anyone know that? I mean, why would that be the case? And are those inmates coordinated somehow in helping the gangs?
Yes. What would a gang do if it wants to wreak havoc? Well, first break into the prisons and let out all the other gang members who are in there so that the gangs grow stronger. And that becomes a threat to regular citizens, obviously, and to the government. Next, they go after the police stations and they start burning them so that the police become disheartened or murdered or they give up. Then they go after the infrastructure. So they're controlling the port already, and they want to control the airport so that they can keep anybody in or out who they don't want to come here to threaten their power. That's what a coup looks like. You know, that's basically what's sort of happening here is, you know, the gangs who most of the time have been warring with each other. There's 400 plus gangs here. So, you know, they're not going to get along, you know, but then normally they're warring with each other for territory or turf. But right now they seem almost united in an effort to overthrow the government because they know this is sort of their last stand. If that Kenyan army contingent comes in here with 1,000 army men, hell-bent on destroying the gangs, this is going to be a major war, and it could be the end of the gangs.
Right. Well, that's a shame, because it just sounds so asinine when you say it out loud that, you know, in this case, this is such a poor country, so devastated by the economics, and the idea that we have the infrastructure and the army and the funding to go over their lickety-split and take care of a bunch of thugs who are just running through the streets. Morality all of a sudden has borders when you don't have an oil interest or a political ally or someone to defend. We're involved in Ukraine. We're involved in Israel. It's just, it's unbelievable to me that if you saw someone hurting in the street, regardless of their economic stature or what nationality they were, you would stop. But the Biden administration is doing nothing to help all these people, as poor and as hurt as they are, and all the kids that you're looking after. I heard you talking to the crew earlier about a baby that you can't get into your orphanage. What was the synopsis there?
Right.
A little HIV baby?
Well, so the gangs invaded a hospital, which is incredible to me that they do this, but they do. And they chase everybody out of the hospitals. They steal all the gear, all the equipment, and I guess they take it, sell it to fund their efforts. And all the patients are left out in the street. They did this actually not too long ago to a tuberculosis hospital. Can you believe that? So that they put people with TB back out into the population. And in today's case, or last week's case, was a hospital that housed HIV babies. And they were scattered, and people just grabbed them and took them. And there's a baby that is doesn't have anybody claiming it. That, you know, that's not uncommon here. When babies have HIV, people sort of abandon them. And so we've agreed to accept this as a little two-month-old boy, but we can't get him here. He's 20 minutes away, and nobody can travel in the streets because it's not safe. And so the woman who's taking care of him keeps saying, well, I tried, but, you know, I can't get there, or the gangs are controlling the street, or everything's blocked, so I can't get there. It's this poor little baby who just needs taken care of, can't even get here for nutrition or food or medicine because 20 minutes is too great a distance to travel in the city if you're going through the wrong neighborhood. And it's unlike anything, Chris, that we can imagine in the States. And I say that because I live in the States. And so I know what life is like when you just want to get in a car and go to a restaurant and go to the bank and go, you know, to a movie. And it's just, there's nothing blocking you. And then all of a sudden you come here, you can't go anywhere. Our kids haven't left this orphanage in 3.5 years. They haven't stepped outside the gates. Can you imagine that? What a life that is. You just can't even go outside because it's too dangerous. No. So, and now it's getting more dangerous, and need help. We need help.
We are, and how inept we are at helping those that genuinely need help in this environment. And I don't want to thump on that topic too hard, but I imagine that you have to be incredibly disheartened and frustrated by the lack of willingness to be helpful. Unbelievable.
It's very frustrating. Yeah.
Listen, we pray for your safety, pal. We hope you get here and can take care of all those kids. You've been doing such a great job. Okay, everybody hang around. We will discuss this a little bit after the break. Back in a few.
Chris, welcome to Focus. Chris Alberta filling in for Paul W. Smith. We just had some technical difficulties here with things freezing.
Wow, what a day, Rieger.
Yeah. What a morning, Chris.
You know, this used to be really simple.
Just you go down froze. The studio,
you sit behind a microphone, you look at you guys through the glass, and then everyone gets all technologically advanced. I'm like, I can do this from my office. I can do it while I'm in Florida or whatever it is. Until something goes slightly wrong and no one knows how to fix it right away.
It just goes to show you that we rely so much on computers these days. And when anything goes wrong or we can't get it to work, it becomes very frustrating.
All right, well, let's have the best second hour of a show that we can possibly have on Wednesday the 6th, since we were derailed a little bit. Obviously, that story with Mitch out of Haiti is just crazy to think about, is it not?
It is. You know, and the work that Mitch does down there is incredible. And it's just, Haiti is just one of those places that is just constant problems, constant issues. Yeah.
Look, we don't have time today for calls and texts because we're jammed. But, you know, I've long been one of those types that says, look, America does not need to be the police of the world. We have no business in a lot of these countries telling them what to do and how to act and how to do their government and interceding, especially with a military intercession ever. But scenarios like this are different, where you have cowards. These gangs are cowards, and they're preying on the weak and the poor and the sick. And they're doing it in a window of time where the leadership of that country, which is already obviously not all that good, is out of the country. They haven't had an election there since 2017, I read. Not that that would have changed anything. But where are we on stuff like this? With the message we're sending is, if we don't have an oil interest, i.e. Middle East, if we don't have an ally interest, i.e. Israel, for example, that's turned into a complete and utter debacle, we're not going to help. And this is one of those times where I think we have a moral responsibility to help. These borders, these lines that are drawn, were drawn by men. And they, you know, separate governments and different ways of thinking and different ways of doing things is fine. But when innocent people are being hurt by brutes and you have the ability to stop them, I think as a human being, you have a moral obligation to step in and stop them. If you remember very early in Trump's presidency, there was a conflict somewhere, and the life of me, it's escaping at the moment. And he said things like, well, we're not the world's police force. We're not going to get involved, until he started seeing videos. This is very early on, I think in his first year of the presidency. And he went in and obliterated the bad guys, saying, that's not okay. You can't do that. You can't burn little kids in the middle of the street. We took care of that. We could take care of this Haiti thing in 2 days. But where are we? Sitting on our hands, arguing about transgender rights and everything else. It's just the stupidest thing I've ever seen. It's shameful that the Biden administration wouldn't do something about this right off the bat. And it would be equally shameful if Trump's administration or anyone else did the same thing.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, something needs to happen so they can try to help. Although, I don't know exactly what the United States would do, but anything would be helpful. Oh,
we could deploy a couple thousand troops over there and make an announcement, and in 2 days that thing would settle down. These people are all in their homes and in behind these fences and walls and things. That would not be that hard to stabilize. It would be a very, very low cost endeavor relative to others. We're sending tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine for a war that just won't end, that we played a role in letting start in the first place in terms of the nuclear stuff. Give me a break.
That's true.
You and I are not prognosticators, but months ago when this Supreme Court thing started getting talked about in terms of the Colorado ruling, taking Trump off the ballot, that other states started.
Oh, that was this is the biggest non-story ever that they were going to put him back on the ballot.
I hosted for like 10 days in a row, and I got beat up hard by a lot of callers for saying this is going to amount to nothing. No one's biting their fingernails over this. The Supreme Court doesn't want to hear the case. There's not much to it. They're going to say it's none of your business. States have no authority to do this. Let the people decide. And that's essentially exactly what they did in a unanimous ruling, despite the fact that some of the actual private letter commentary that was written by some of the judges said, look, we think this should have been a little bit more narrow. We might be creating precedent that would be used, you know, incorrectly in future instances like this. But should we even have future instances of, you know, quote unquote insurrection? I would hope not.
No, I mean, we all knew this was coming to get to this point. Yeah. We all knew that it was going to be former President Trump against President Biden, and the roles have reversed. Back the last election, it was Biden coming after Trump. And now it is Trump coming after Biden. It's just a little bit of a reversal, but we all knew that it was happening.
Well, why is Trump coming after Biden?
As far as just being that Biden, you know, he's not the incumbent. That's what I mean. I mean, like Trump, well,
I mean, some of the things that are levied against the Biden family right now, President Joe Biden included, are appropriate and they should be levied against them and adjudicated properly and so on and so forth. If you do bad business, you do bad business and you need to be called out on it, right? Nothing is stuck to Donald Trump. Whether or not he's totally innocent of all these charges remains to be seen. That's going to continue to go on and on. But the liberal meltdown about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court saying, nope, you can't do that, back off, that should have ended everything. But now, I mean, look, I don't even want to give credence to the Whoopi Goldbergs of the world, right? Did you hear her comments the other day?
I did not, but I'm sure I could.
She's on this idiotic show, The View. I mean, that show should be burned to the ground. Who watches The View, for crying out loud?
I think it's a lot of viewers.
Well, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard, because you go from like Ricky Lake to, you know, who are other some of this crazy talk show people that had, you know, that, you know, you name it, transvestite communist aliens being interviewed.
I mean, Jerry Springer. Jerry Springer's, show. You had Phil Donahue back in the day. You had Oprah. You had Rosie O'Donnell had a show.
Right. So if what she's saying on the show is that if you're going to give presidential immunity, then since Joe Biden is president, he should throw all the Republicans in jail.
Okay.
It's just the silliest nonsense ever. And Keith Olbermann, right, an already mediocre sportscaster at best turned activist on a podcast with 11 people listening to it on a regular basis, you know, he's going off the ledge and he's going to move and what a state of the country.
Okay, no matter what you think of Trump, I'm not sure I understand this. I'm going to move. I don't understand that whole thing. Where are you going?
Give me a break.
Where are you moving? I don't understand that. Listen, I hear a lot of people say that. That makes no sense.
Rieger, I can tell you as a guy deeply, deeply embedded in a lot of these conversations, that the tremendous amount of conservative friends and some libertarian friends and quite a few liberal friends, almost everybody admits that during Trump's presidency, their life couldn't have been better. Economically, it was fine. Prices were low. Unemployment was low. The market was booming. Everything was fine. You might not have liked the guy. I didn't particularly like the guy. I think he rambles on like a lunatic, and he's arrogant and pompous and petulant.
Unfortunately, I think that what did Trump in was COVID was a big part of it, though.
And the debates were the biggest part of it, because every incumbent president is secretly in desire of a crisis of some magnitude that they can handle to show people that they are sympathetic, to show people that they're in control. And when damn near 50% of the country votes for you, despite the fact that he actually lost the election, he was just a hair away from winning.
He was.
Let the American people decide who they want to be in charge. And if it backfires, it backfires, and you go ahead and move on. I have never understood this kind of meltdown. I've never seen it from any real party except the far left. And it's just, I mean, good grief. Is it ever going to stop?
I don't think so. I think the politics has changed.
Is cool with Roe too, because if you look at everything that's going on right now, the two-party system is so deeply embroiled in their own cronyism and their betrothed to the lobbyists and so on and so forth. Well, have you listened to any of the RFK Jr. YouTube things that he's done or any of the speeches?
I've seen a couple of just a few, a little bit, but I think that he's a little weird himself. The way that he thinks and the way, you know, his whole COVID thing is a little weird to me, but.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, some of the things he's been redeemed in, and I think much of what makes the average person who doesn't know a lot about him personally or about his political leanings, much of what forms their opinion, shapes their opinion, is the smear job that both the left and the right have done to him.
I think it'll be interesting to see also President Biden's State of the Union tomorrow, too.
Yeah. I don't know if I can stay awake for that long, but I don't know if he can stay awake to do it either.
I hear you.
They're on both sides. Listen, when we get back, Evan Brown's going to join from Fox News, talk to us about the spring break dilemma down in Florida. Everyone hang tight. Back in a few. Well, if you haven't noticed, it certainly doesn't feel like it today, but spring is in the air, a little early spring with a couple 65 and 70 degree days popping up. And that means for us that trees are going to start budding and flowers will pop up and we can start playing golf again and work around the garden. But for hundreds of thousands of kids all across the country, if not the better part of a million, they'll be flocking to places like the coast of Texas and certainly to Florida for spring break. And spring break has gradually gotten somewhat out of control, and out of control to the extent that Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida just recently held a press conference about Miami Beach and some others specifically. And Evan Brown, Fox News affiliate, joins us. Evan, what's going on, my friend? What do we know about this story? How bad has it gotten on an ongoing basis in Florida during the spring break?
Yeah, good afternoon. It's certainly getting worse and worse as the years go by. Last year, there were two shootings on Miami Beach, which is generally a very safe place to be. But those shootings were fatal. There was a lot of big old messes going on. And police arrested nearly 500 people, confiscated 100 firearms, and had to institute curfews and closing down alcohol sales and things like that. Which probably made for a not so great spring break experience for a lot of people who probably saved up all year to come, or got mom and dad to pay for it, or however it works these days. But it's been a growing problem, both at spring break. Also, Memorial Day weekend is another issue. But whether it's in Miami or Fort Lauderdale or Daytona or the other side of the state, Clearwater and Fort Myers and up by on the Panhandle, Pensacola, Panama City Beach, there have been problems with visitors who don't act respectfully and cause a lot of trouble and a lot of grief, and that comes at the expense of the locals. And so the governor, Ron DeSantis, is allowing for either money to pay officer overtime or to hire off-duty officers, or is sending or dispatching Florida State Troopers and highway and Florida Division of Law Enforcement agents to assist in keeping the peace and organizing for license plate checks of cars coming in and bag checks and more enforcement of laws on the beaches themselves about open containers and things like that. So that's something that they're doing in hopes of A, discouraging bad conduct, but also keeping people safe, because nowhere in the state is anyone telling people not to come for spring break. We actually want them to come. It's a big business for us.
Absolutely.
There's no reason why people can't come and have a good time and not act a fool and get into trouble and cause death and pain and destruction. And I don't think that's really too much to ask. So that's kind of where we are. We're hoping to not see a repeat of last year like we saw in Miami Beach, where people died and a lot of people ended up in jail.
Yeah, Evan, as I read through a handful of these stories, you know, preparing myself to talk to you about this, I think we all recognize that some of the party culture, and it's not just college kids, I mean, this is attracting people who are not in college the same way, for example, Mardi Gras, where they're all like little mini Mardi Gras, and some of them can get wildly out of hand. The complaints about this kind of activity in terms of upping security seem to come from racial motivation things. Quite a bit of the Black community seems to really enjoy the Miami Beach area. It is steadily increased every year in terms of the amount of Black folks that go down there. What have you read on that or seen on that that lends any plausibility to that particular idea that there's a racial component to this, or is that just kind of nonsensical?
Well, we have everyone who comes down. So, I mean, in that regard, we have visitors from all demographic groups at all times during the year. Has there been a problem with regard to, let's say, we'll call it almost hip-hop culture? In some cases, yes. The Memorial Day weekend, for instance, has long been known as an unofficial festival, meaning it's not an actual festival, but a lot of people do show up, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing. I used to live on Miami Beach. Memorial Day weekend was very difficult because there were certain people who were very obnoxious. They would harass the residents, especially the elderly ones. They would trespass on private property and so on. But that wasn't necessarily because it was one group or another. It's because people in general were acting a fool. And so there were moves to try to dissuade this by some hotels would actually close for that weekend. And so they got in trouble with civil rights groups saying that they were closing because they didn't want African-American guests that weekend. And the response was, no, we're closing because we don't want anyone to come in and trash the rooms, which is what happened to our property last year. That's been an ongoing struggle and an ongoing kind of a fight. But we have seen year after year after year increased police enforcement to try to tamp down on bad crime that happens, because it is the local residents that do end up kind of with a mess on their hands afterwards.
Sure.
As someone who used to live in Miami Beach, I've lived in an apartment in an apartment building where the empty units would be rented out during spring break, you know, for vacation rental style stuff. And it was kind of a hellish nightmare. I mean, I would get the door pounded on at 3 or 4 in the morning, asking, "Hey, do you have any extra tequila or whatever?" And it's like, "No, dude, I got to get up in the morning and go to work. You're in my house."
The last time I went down there for spring break was in the very early 90s when I was a senior in high school. We went to Daytona Beach, and that was, you know, of course, prior to there being things like VRBO and Airbnb. Have the hotel businesses that are on the big strips there in Daytona and Panama and Miami, have they taken a hit at all as, you know, 10 kids look to just get a house together? You would think to some degree that actually mitigates the massive party atmosphere, you know, going door to door and down in the lobby and on the beach of the hotel. Is that not an effect that they've seen?
I don't really think so, because a lot of this party then just moves out to the streets. And so I don't know if that the Airbnb thing has really kind of, you know, abated any problems. It may have just shifted the problems. But in the same way, the owners of Airbnb or Vrbo properties are very cautious at these times of year, because they don't want their property being destroyed either. You know, they don't want to have to come into the property after a spring break crowd rented it out and the furniture is destroyed, the walls have holes in them. There's been a fire or something like that. And these are, you know, these are real concerns, and it does cause them to maybe perhaps drive up prices. Or drive up a security deposit type deals in order to dissuade people from mistreating and abusing the property that they're renting for that week.
Got it. Yeah. Evan, thanks for joining the show today. Let's cross our fingers that everyone has a safe and fun spring break if they decide to go down to Florida. Keep everyone safe. Listen, after the break, we're going to talk a little bit about daylight savings time. You don't want to miss it. Everyone hang around. All right, I hope you're ready to lose an hour of sleep. You know, twice a year we have this debate about whether daylight savings time is really necessary. It hits some people harder than others, but as we roll into spring, we're going to roll back the clocks on the 10th. And for some people, it's a heck of an event. They're late for church, or they get all screwed up for the entire week. Some people just don't operate well if they get outside their schedule. I know I'm one of them, but I'll just wake up at a different time on the clock, and I'll have to reset the microwave and go through all the different appliances to make sure they're right. But to give us some insight on how this really affects people, we're lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Kathleen Yaremchuk from Henry Ford Health Sleep Disorders Center. I hope that was a mouthful. Kathleen, thanks for joining the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Kathleen, is this really, these two events every year, are they really a thing that people look at as something that's disruptive, or is it just kind of time to talk about it because you do sleep and everyone's sleep is a touch affected twice a year?
It's a big deal, and it's a big deal for a lot of reasons. And if you want to just look at numbers, the number of car accidents, motor vehicle accidents, increase 6%. The week after daylight savings time, because basically what we're doing is we're taking an hour of sleep away from everyone. And since we are in a sleep deprived culture as it is, taking another hour puts us all at risk for not having the vigilance we need in driving and working, and being a little bit grumpy as well at home.
Sure. I know this it sounds like antagonistic from me, and I don't mean it to sound that way, but if we see an increase of 6% in motor vehicle accidents, for example, do we see a decrease earlier in the year, or later in the year rather, when the clock rolls back?
There is actually some evidence that the safety, so the baseline does go down some. The problem for many of us, though, is that it takes at least a week to adjust, either attracting time. And we can talk about our body clock, which is what time does the sun go up and what time does the sun go down. And then the other part of it is your social clock. You know, people expect you to be coming for dinner at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, but your internal clock tells you it's 8 or 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah. That is interesting. And you're obviously you're in the sleep business, right? If we were out somewhere and I said, what do you do? You said, I do sleep, or I'm a doctor of sleep. Or do we severely, as human beings at this point, with all the technology we have and all the data points that could be accessed, do we underestimate the importance of sleep in general?
I think people are just starting to notice how important it is. You know, for a while we've talked about, you know, eating right and making sure that we hydrate correctly and that we stay away from sugars. And I think the third part of that now is recognizing how important sleep is to all of us, and that you can undersleep or insufficient sleep will wreak havoc on our daily activities and our performance. And, you know, we talk about adults, but this is really much more important for our teenagers. And so listeners who have teenagers at home, you know, we talk about adults needing 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Teenagers need 9 to 10 hours of sleep. And yet they're getting up and going to school at 7 a.m. and they are burning the midnight oil, studying, or going to sports practices. So all of us need to be very aware, very cognizant of what insufficient sleep leads to.
Yeah, Kathleen, as it pertains to daylight savings time in particular, are there a few very generic, easy, simple things that folks could do to help themselves adjust quicker? Is it perhaps, you know, going to bed a touch earlier the prior night, staying, you know, not getting in the car at the crack of dawn, whatever it might be? I mean, what are the lowest hanging fruit for this specific instance?
You hit on almost all of them. And so one of them is, you're right, you can't adjust an hour overnight. So Saturday night when you go to bed and all of a sudden you wake up Sunday morning, your body is not going to be adjusted. So usually the most we can adjust is about 15 minutes a night. So if you're normally going to bed at 10, you know, tonight it should be 9:45, tomorrow 9:30, 9:15, 9 o'clock, so that you don't get that big 1 hour deficit at one time. And I kind of mentioned the idea of a body clock and a social clock, but every body has that circadian rhythm. And so delaying your dinner an hour and then going to sleep, you may not have finished your digestion. And so moving your meals up, moving your sleep time up, and trying not to have distractions in the bedroom at night when you do go to sleep. So put that phone away, stop texting, stop looking at emails, and prepare for a night's rest.
Yeah, Kathleen, this is tangential to this conversation, but I go back and forth to Arizona and California quite a bit. And with a 2 and 3 hour time change, I often find myself almost wanting to pull an all-nighter the first night that I get there, so that I'm so darn tired by the second day I actually can go to bed on time, which for me is relatively early because I'm such an early riser. Is that a bad idea for people? Should you just, if you go through a time change of any kind, should you just do your best to stay on schedule? And if you get shortchanged one night, that circadian clock, it kind of revolves itself back into rhythm. And then eventually you just fall into a good deep slumber and get that 7 or 8 hours back.
It's possible. And so I think you're talking about one-offs as opposed to chronically being sleep deprived. So for individuals that chronically get 5 to 6 hours of sleep, they're going to pay the price for it. If you do it once or twice a month or something like that, you can probably do well and not have a problem. Right. It's as important to the minute the sun is probably the strongest driver of our circadian rhythm. And sometimes we can augment it. And one of the things we can do is the proverbial cup of coffee in the morning or some caffeine, as well as some exercise. And so you get the adrenaline, you get the caffeine, and you have your circadian rhythm with the sunshine, and you'll be in much better shape than trying to drive all of those systems without any help at all.
Yeah. On that note, what are some of the lowest hanging fruit for people who are looking for better sleep? I tell people oftentimes that the chili pad concept, you know, temperature control, saved me when it came to sleep. I was sleeping way too hot. I sleep much, much better when I'm cooler. Is there anything else like that that you could just throw out there for people who maybe just have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep that is a relatively easy, cheap fix?
Well, I'm going to suggest, much like you said, a cool bedroom is much easier. The other thing that helps is to make sure that it is dark and no distractions. And there are many people that fall asleep with the TV on. And the thing is, you really are listening to that. Subconsciously, you're listening to it. And we've all seen where you walk into the room, shut off the TV, and the person wakes up and says, I was watching that. They may have been snoring, they may have been sleeping, but they're in a very light sleep as opposed to a deep sleep. Cool bedroom, dark, no extraneous electronics, texting, don't be looking at the clock, no TV running in the background. White is a fan is probably fine because you're not really concentrating on it. And recognizing that really what you need to focus on is not so much what time you go to bed, but what time you wake up. We need between 7 and 8 hours of sleep a night. So if you need to get up at 7, that means you need to be in bed by 11 to get that sleep.
Yeah, Kathleen, as we close out this segment, and again, thanks for coming on. This is interesting stuff in general. There, much now has been peer-reviewed and printed and available on the effects of sleep regularity, sleep duration, and longevity. Do you feel that more people really should know what the long-term effects of their sleep patterns will be on their longevity?
I think that is so important. And I you may have heard the saying, you know, when I'm dead, I'll have plenty of time to sleep. And the point is, if you're not sleeping, you may reach that endpoint a little bit earlier. So less than 6 hours of sleep a night, six or less, you're less likely to burn calories. You're more likely to have high blood pressure, more likely to have poor glycemic control, be diabetic. And so individuals who pride themselves on that 6 hours or less are doing some damage that is going to be long-term for them.
Yeah. Kathleen Yaremchuk from Henry Ford Health System Sleep Disorder Center, thanks for joining the program as we get ready to turn the clocks ahead on March 10th. Interesting stuff. Let's check in with Chris Renwick when we get back. Well, thanks for joining as we close out this 2 hours here, giving Paul a break for the day. Cut a little bit short by technical difficulties. Fun show, though. We learned a lot today. I didn't get to do the story with Marie about dyslexia. Jason Rowe joined us. We talked a little bit about RFK Jr., who Chris Renwick I've come to really adore in terms of watching. And I'm getting more on the Kennedy Jr. train.
Are you?
I don't know that I'll end up there, but Chris, you know me pretty well. The libertarian streak in me cannot go away. Mm-hmm. It's just so deeply in my DNA and the fiber of me. And I am so dissatisfied with the way that the parties are beholden to special interest groups and lobbyists. And they're very much a cronyism that I have come to abhor. And the more I've listened to Bobby Jr., despite his quirks and his oddities, I feel like that is the most reasonable guy I've seen in the public arena in a long time. And if more people listened to what he was saying, even the little, I feel sad for him that he does these fabulous little YouTube things, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, you know, on special interest groups, on private equity, on the COVID vaccines, on how to end stuff in Ukraine, all of these things. And then you look at it, it's got 100,000 views. There's 90 million people that are going to vote. 100,000 doesn't even move the needle. And I had Jay Rowe on, you know, he's a buddy of mine, obviously, to talk about that a little bit. And I'm kind of shocked, man. I don't know what to make of it other than, are we just really going to have this dictated to us? These are the preordained choices, neither of which so many people like?
Yes. Short answer, yeah.
Yeah. Tremendous.
Yeah, I know. It's not a great answer, but I believe it's the correct one. You know, Bobby Kennedy was on with Altalk a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about his polling with younger people, particularly under the ages of 45. That is going to go a long way towards determining the inevitable president. What I am just steadfast in believing is that a third party candidate in this country in 2024, that third party candidate will not be elected president. That candidate will more, the storyline will be about, and it certainly will be Robert F. Kennedy, is certainly going to be about who he takes votes away from.
Yeah, of course.
And I guess the only thing that I go back to is Donald Trump's base is so steadfast. They're so rock solid. They ain't going nowhere. Joe Biden's base seems to be flaking off bit by bit by bit, which is indicative in some of the polling that we're seeing. So I think that in 2024, no, a third party candidate is not going to be president. But Who are they taking votes away from? To me, it's Joe Biden. I think that spells trouble for the incumbent.
Listen, I get it. I think it's just shameful that we have got ourselves into a very binary situation. Mm-hmm. It's not the doing of the American people so much as the doing is of the two-party system, what the founding fathers had warned us against all those years ago. And I do genuinely believe that Donald Trump, in terms of his ability to run the country, despite the animal house that comes along with it of media and the popular media in the news, especially, going to be vehemently against him. Will they try and impeach him every 15 minutes like they did last time, knowing that this is the last time around? That remains to be seen, should he win. But I just think it's a sad state of affairs. And what shocks me the most, frankly, even though that the young people are getting behind Bobby Jr., which I understand, really it's the 60, it's 55, maybe 60 and up crowd that identify with him the most. I mean, I have clients in the retirement business that are very, very much like him. They have some things on the right that they agree with. They have some things on the left they agree with. And they think the whole thing is disgusting, how divisive it's gotten. Mm-hmm. Those are the same people that would listen to him speak and go, yeah, see, that's what I'm talking about. Why can't we have leadership like that? Why can't we be laying in bed the night before the election, still on the fence about who to vote for? Because both choices are so darn good.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think money plays a huge factor here in the two-party system. You know, it almost feels like RFK Jr. has been labeled as some crazy conspiracy theorist. He's been labeled as an anti-vax nut and you know, whatever, all that stuff.
Yeah, labeled by who, Chris?
Well, labeled by places like CNN, MSNBC.
By the left media.
Correct.
And every time he has a chance to respond, when he actually responds, and he's a master at
absolutely.
He says, that wasn't me.
Correct.
You guys said that. I didn't say that.
Correct. And so I think until you have, but that picture can be painted, right, of him and of his history, you know, even going back when he was an environmental lawyer. So until you have a third party candidate that is basically untouchable, until you have a third party candidate that is so squeaky clean that you can't paint a narrative, this is the way of the world in the United States in our political system.
Yeah, unfortunate but true. Listen, have a fabulous show today. Hopefully, thanks, I'll be checking in with you soon. I'm back a couple times to fill in for Paul. And until then, best wishes, everybody. Have a great day.